I'm Ross.
And I'm Graham.
This is our show about anything and everything off-road. Tonight, we're socially distanced as always. Ross is in the Northeast, I'm in the Midwest, and Graham's down in Mexico. So we're just kind of spread out all over the place. So thank you for joining us, Graham.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Ross, do you want to give us your update to begin the show?
Yeah, we'll delve quickly into my recent adventures since we didn't cover them last night. Or last week, rather.
If last you're week.
Last week, yeah. My brother and I went out to Pennsylvania to the Lost Trails ATV Park on the Press Quad Tour, as I'll call it. I was riding
Press
the
Quad Tour.
Yes. I was riding the Polaris Scrambler XP1000S for the probably last time before it goes back to the manufacturer in a few weeks. And my soul weeps because it's amazing. And my brother is riding the Can-Am Outlander XT700, which is Can-Am's new way of going about like the mid to slight big bore world. It used to have a V-twin. It used to be a 650-ish cc V-twin, and now they're doing a big single instead. So they want us to dive in and understand, you know, singles are a little bit lighter, but they're a little less torquey, and how does it interact with everything you do with a quad? So we're playing with this thing to see what it's like. And yeah, this was the first time we've been riding quads since 2000. I think like March of 2004 was the first time I rode a quad on a trail with, you know, any kind of actual integrity or like difficulty to it. And this was the first time in that entire 2-decade span that my brother and I went without our dad. And he didn't join because he managed to mangle his Polaris Razor on the last trip the two of them did themselves, which, you know, U-joints, as it turns out, are a fail point, not just in the Razor community or the Jeep community, but kind of universally. And yeah, it was weird just being myself and my brother, because it's our father is the reason that we're in the off-road world. You know, my earliest memories are of being in the back of his YJ Wrangler in the woods on the trails. And that's, long story short, and I know I've said this before, that's the the path that has ultimately led me to be here and to be doing this show and to be in this community and this world. And for him to sit this one out, and you know, we've had combinations, me and my dad, my brother and my dad, all three of us, but this was the first time it was just the two of us. And we had a day. We you can see the pictures here. This place, Lost Trails, has novelties. They have a half mile long old abandoned railroad tunnel that you ride down that has water dripping off the ceiling. And if you're lucky, it has bats. Sometimes there are bats.
Or if you're unlucky, it has bats.
No, they're friendly bats. They don't bother you. They don't make noise, so they're gone. it's a cool thing to see. And then there's this big top of the world thing where there's like a, you know, multi-hundred foot cliff that you can basically just like peer over. So we had a good day. We decided to abandon ship on pulling the quads on the trailer with the Colorado ZR2 press truck. And instead use my dad's Silverado 2500 with the big Duramax. But
right,
yeah,
because the Colorado was not happy.
The Colorado wasn't happy with 3,300 pounds, and it would have been a lot less happy with 5,500 pounds. So yeah, but overall, great day. My brother will be on hopefully soon to talk about it, and to talk about, this is actually also the first time that he's ridden a quad on a trail that isn't our local club since 2016. He's been in the side-by-side world. since then. So it'll be interesting to get him on. And, you know, he's a, I'm going to call him an up and coming journalist. And I think he knows deep in his soul that he's got the chops to actually write and be good at this stuff. And shit, he wouldn't be spending his own money on all this stuff too. You know, his Forerunner and his Can-Am Maverick, if this wasn't where he wanted to be. So, yeah, it's great.
Ahead, dumb question. Because I know he's got a Can-Am Maverick. Does your dad always tow that one? Because he doesn't tow that with a Forerunner, does he?
No. They usually put the two side-by-sides on. They have like a 20-ish foot car trailer, aluminum.
Okay.
Well, it's steel. It's mostly steel, but it's also got a couple pieces of aluminum. They have a car trailer with a, you know, like a normal off the back of the truck hitch. And they tow it with that. But yeah, he doesn't tow the Forerunner. But yeah, it's great having people you love the things you love. Sure. That's where I'll leave it. Yeah, that's where I'll leave it.
I'll say sure, because I go by myself a lot. So.
Yeah, we'll dive deeper into this trip in an upcoming episode when we'll go, you know, real in depth. That's it.
So let's talk about Graham stuff. It's way more fun.
Graham stuff is a lot.
I like those
more
quotes, though. I look at those things and it reminds me, we were on the beach in Mozambique, and I had a girlfriend from high school, and she has a campsite. And I was nervous going there because it was my wife and my girlfriend from high school. But anyway, she had a 500cc quad bike.
Oh my God.
And man, we were ripping around in that thing. Oh, it was great fun. I mean, I've often thought about getting a toy trailer to pull behind the landing, just like a quad bike. You call it quad bikes, right?
Calling quads, four-wheelers, ATVs, kind of whatever you feel like calling them.
Yeah, quad, a kayak, a surfboard, some fishing rods so I can't catch any fish. Because I'm the worst fisherman in the world. But anyway, yeah, that would be awesome. I think that would be a great way to travel.
I think I can challenge you for that worst fisherman title.
Oh, no, it's impossible.
Exactly.
I couldn't catch a fish at a fish market.
So my dad was really into fly fishing, and so he got me into fly fishing. I got all the gear, and he calls it fly fishing. I call it hiking in rivers because I never caught fish. I would just hike in the water a lot. So, Graham, do you want to give like a 30-second elevator pitch of why we might have you on the show?
Who you are, what you've done.
I'm quite boring. Yeah,
I don't think it's boring.
I have, for the last 13 odd years, been traveling around the world with my family in a Land Rover Defender. It was originally a double cab with a rooftop tent, but after 4 years of living in a tent virtually every day, we converted it into a camper. We have traveled close to circumnavigating Africa, but COVID got in the way. We've traveled across the US, I don't know how many times, up to Alaska, across Europe, around Europe, and into the Western Middle East. And our most recent adventure this year, other than getting the Landy from South Africa, is we drove a nimble camper up to the Arctic Ocean in March.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's still cold, like really cold.
It was minus 50 on the ocean.
Minus 50?
Minus 50.
Is it ever cold out there?
That's cold enough that it doesn't matter which scale we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Minus 40 is when they sink up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thermometer just says cold.
It was so cold. We were in a school. We were doing presentations at the school in Tuktoyaktuk for all the for the kids, just telling them our stories and showing them photos and stuff. And it was so cold. I think they announced it was minus 46, so the kids weren't allowed to go outside.
Oh,
and we were camping the whole time. We didn't stay in a hotel once, except for, I think, in Whitehorse we stayed in for a night.
You said it's 13 years on the road?
Pretty much.
Is that the coldest you've experienced?
Oh, hell yeah, absolutely. I'm from South Africa, man.
What's the hottest?
Not even our freezers get that cold in South Africa.
So what's the hottest that you've experienced, the highest temperatures that suffered through?
Well, there's different types of heat. One of the worst was in Balwista. No, is it Balwista?
Where is that?
Up in way northern Brazil, up in the Amazon.
Okay.
It was 40 degrees Celsius at 6 o'clock on a Sunday evening.
What?
And four of us were sleeping in the
for us.
Yeah.
Uneducated Yankees.
And all four of us were sleeping in the roof tent, and there was no breeze whatsoever.
Oh my god,
that was pretty hot.
Like almost equator. Like you're getting closer to the equator at that point.
Yeah. North of the equator there.
North of the
equator. And then West Africa, it was boiling hot. Once I think we got south of Senegal, it was 40 degrees. It was 112 every day.
Oh.
And that was for 4 months. That was hot. That was damn hot. That was too hot.
That's pretty gnarly.
Lose your mind hot.
So you've obviously been living the same kind of, is nomadic the right word for it?
Yeah.
Like pick up and move your own existence and the people with you and your living quarters from place to place. How do you adapt when you, I mean, obviously it's usually a gradual change from place to place, but you've acclimated to adaptation from culture and climate?
In the beginning it was tough because everything was new, and I'm talking about international overlanding, of course. Everything was new. The first time you cross into a country that speaks a completely different language, the rules of the law, the road rules, the everything is completely different, and it's very, very difficult to get used to. But now I actually say that we don't even really notice anymore. We're just so used to the change of cultures that you just kind of roll with it.
Change is the norm.
Yeah, it's, and we got really used to being stared at. Just being the only gigantic Viking looking people.
I was gonna say, how often have you been referred to as the white devil?
Never.
Okay, good.
Never.
Good.
Well, not in a language I understood.
okay, that makes sense.
It was probably said. But...
Yeah, it might have been said. I remember in Senegal coming around the corner and I surprised this little kid. I don't think she'd ever seen a white guy before, and she lost it.
Wow.
She thought the devil was at her doorstep.
That's funny.
Yeah, that was pretty spooky for her and funny for me.
I remember somebody I knew met somebody from Ohio when we were in like high school. Like, I've never met a Jewish person before. It's amazing I met a Jewish person. I was like, you live in Ohio? This isn't
exist in Ohio, more prolific on the East Coast.
to meet a white person when you live in Senegal is a lot more plausible.
The thing is, we also go far from the beaten track, you know. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of the tourists will go to the beach, whereas we'll be heading out on, you know, the roads connecting the countries and stuff like that. So we'll end up camping in the middle of a village.
That
just doesn't see traffic. You know,
exploring the culture and the community and what the country or place that you're going to is about, instead of just staying at a hotel and, you know, like saying you went there.
Yeah, on that day in Senegal, I think we had gone to the local store to buy some food, and they eat baguettes because of the French influence.
Mm-hmm.
And they smear them with these, they got these buckets of Nutella, Well, Nutella kind of rip off. There's like 20-gallon buckets, and they just smear it all over your baguette. So we were on a mission for a chocolate baguette that day.
How much do you think?
So that photo that you're looking at there, that's in Morocco.
Okay,
it is in Morocco. Okay.
Yeah.
So you've adapted your vehicle has adapted over time. What any lessons
or
things you can say that everybody thinks they should have, but are totally useless and unnecessary in instances and adventures like this?
You know, the advice that I always give is that people must establish their style of travel before they choose their vehicle. Too many times because you don't need a 4x4 to travel around the world. You could do it in a 1982 Mini Cooper. You could do it on a tuk-tuk. You could do it on a bicycle.
You do it on foot, on bike.
Yeah, you know, there's so many ways to do it. But
moped.
People read the articles and watch the YouTube videos, and they see 37-inch tires. They see high lift jacks and bull bars and winches front and back, and they see every gadget and gizmo known to man bolted onto this poor thing, and they think, well, I got to have that.
Right.
And I use an example of a couple that I tried to steer correct a few years ago, and they were, you know, they had this big Toyota with big tires. They were both under 5 feet tall. Rooftop tent, big dog, this, that, and the other. And I was like, dude, you've got the wrong vehicle. Go back to the States, sell it, get a van, right? Because that's what you're going to be doing. You're not going to be using this thing to its full potential.
Right.
Get a van. They didn't listen to me. And I think if they had, they probably would have had a better journey. It would have been a lot less Instagram worthy, perhaps, but it would have suited them better for what they wanted to do.
Well,
so yeah, I think the advice would be like, understand what you want from travel. Like, are you going to go 4x4? Yeah, are you going to go through the jungles? Or are you more interested in going to see the cultural highlights and sticking to the main roads and doing stuff like that, you know? You can save yourself a lot of time and money and stress if you just get it right the first time. And I didn't get it right the first time.
Right. How did you realize that you didn't get it right the first time?
I think it was the absolute rebellion that was happening in our campsite. Because there were four of us sleeping in one roof tent. Yeah, I know. It was a revolution brewing. So when we started out, the goal was to go 18 months Argentina to Alaska. And it eventually became clear to us there was absolutely nothing else we wanted to do with our lives. And then we kind of realized, well, you know, it's okay. I mean, if you're going for an 18-month journey, that you could suffer through a rooftop tent for that long with kids. Mm-hmm.
With kids is the caveat.
But when it becomes a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah, when it becomes a lifestyle, then it's like, yeah, you need a different way of traveling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, but that's the adaptability that you're talking about. Adaptability can be at the front end, the back end, or the middle. You know, if you have a vision for what you want to do, but the wrong vehicle, or, you know, the right vehicle, but the wrong vision, it's all about how you make those changes from A to B. And in the same capacity, that could be putting a camper on the back of a Tacoma instead of having, you know, it full of tools you'll never use. But yeah, it's interesting. And it doesn't seem like there's a lot of Defenders being overlanded this way. It seems like everybody's doing Toyotas now.
If you're talking about the Americas, yeah. But you go to Europe and you can still pick up. Side note, I'm in Mexico. There's always barking dogs. I hope so.
You're part
of the oil journey.
Yeah.
Is that the right word? I don't think so. Where were we? Oh, yeah. So if you go to Europe, I mean, there's so many countries that use Defenders for the military. And for infrastructure vehicles or municipal vehicles or ambulances or whatever. So, you know, you'll still see there's a ton of Europeans traveling with Defenders. And you'll see them a bunch. And they don't mind messing them up. The thing is, the Defenders that you're getting in the States these days, people are paying up to like $150,000 for these things. So there's no way they're going to they can do the things that we did, like chop the thing up and put a box on the back. There's no way they're going to do that. So well, yeah, the
Defenders if you pay.
Toyotas in the Americas, the Toyotas are very, very popular, especially North America.
Yeah, we unfortunately didn't get the Defender in the capacity that the rest of the world did. We had it in a very short-lived Fashioneer, short wheelbase two-door. But yeah, we're starting to see Defenders a little bit. We were talking today about Disco 2s, Discovery 2s, which keep it in the
You're going to have, sorry to interrupt, you're going to have more Defenders than the rest of the world eventually. Because every Tom, Dick, and Harry is buying them up, slapping some paint on them, and a set of tires and selling them for three times what they bought them for. And they're coming from everywhere. They're coming from Turkey, South Africa, UK, you name it.
I thought you were going to say because they're selling the new Defender here faster than they can even keep them on the shelf. Call it a Defender, call it a Disco 4, you know, or a,
it's whatever. A good vehicle. It's a good vehicle. I'd travel with it, you know, but it would be a different type of travel. It'd be like a, it's incredibly capable, the new Defender off-road.
They are, yeah.
And it's comfortable and it's smart and it's powerful and all of those things that my Defender is. but you can hack mine apart and bolt things to it and do all kinds of crazy shit to it. And it'll shrug it off. You know, and that's, I think that's the beauty of the older vehicle is it's utilitarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to fix it in the bush. It's a very different story.
Oh,
yeah. And we fix it in the bush. You know, like my wife, she's our electrician.
I was saying, who does the wiring?
Louisa does the wiring. We actually broke down in the Congo in the middle of the bush. And it was a bad day to break down because it was a Sunday and all the locals were drunk out of their minds on palm wine and they were boot smacking the car and trying to get us to stop. And I was just smiling and I kept going. But I had a Japanese hitchhiker in the back. My daughter had malaria. It was a shit show. Oh, God. Yeah, and the Land Rover wouldn't go up hills because it was just stuttering so bad. We kind of figured it was probably the crank position sensor, the wiring.
Mm-hmm.
And we found a little place to pull over, and my wife fixed it in the middle of the bush, and then my son cooked us a steak and gave us cold beer.
You can write that as a script if you tried. That is a day.
Oh, yeah. That's when beer is very precious.
Touché. Touché.
I'm scrolling for jungle photos now just in case.
Yeah, and I'm looking at our show notes going, oh my God, I have like 4 hours of things to talk about here. So given your experience and expeditions and where you've been and what you've seen, can you give some basic, like, do not under any circumstance do this kind of tips or things that you wish you had known before you set out on this journey that you're on?
Those are two separate questions though. So,
they intertwine.
The do not do is do not be an idiot. Do not be disrespectful. Do not, just don't be insensitive. Don't be inconsiderate. Yeah, kill them with dangerous kindness. Well, yeah, but also, you know, you're at the mercy of the other cultures as you travel, and you have to treat them with respect because they deserve respect. And you, and I've come across people with very, very bad attitudes, and I've convoyed with people with very, very bad attitudes, and that lasted until I realized, and yeah, got out of it. But you see the situations you can get into and you've got a bad attitude and you can get guns pulled on you, you can get arrested, you can get all kinds of stuff happen. And it's just not worth it. And it's actually the one thing that, yeah, that I learned very quickly is have a very healthy dose of humility that serves you very, very well.
That's a good life lesson, not just tied to the, you know, to what you're doing. But yeah, no, it when you're in other unfamiliar territories, yeah, that is a good thing to remind yourself of.
It's essential. And when people, you treat people with respect and they don't expect you to treat them with respect, it actually disarms them. Policemen or thugs or whatever. I could tell you stories that can go on for days, but I'm not gonna. But yeah, humility is an important one. So the second part of the question was, what do I wish I had known then?
Mm-hmm.
I think over the years I've really learned, and this is a counterbalance to the humility thing, is that I've learned the self-confidence. Which is not arrogance, I don't think. I try not to be arrogant.
There's a big disparity between the two of those.
It's a self-belief that if I do the right things right, I'll get the outcome that I want. If I put the hard yards in, I'm going to get the result. It will take time, but I'll get it. And that's what this journey has taught me, is to really invest the time and put in the hard yards, work hard and believe in myself. Because, I mean, there's been times where we've been in the middle of a continent, we've run out of cash, we've cars broken down, we're screwed, you know, and you just got to, like, if I lose my shit, the whole family's going to fall apart, you know?
Yeah.
So I've got to just be like, hey guys, it's cool. And then I go and have a walk and have a talk to myself and figure it out and then figure it out. And just keep going.
So dealing with shit when shit happens in mind, do you have any advice for people who are preparing to or looking long term to embark on any kind of intercontinental overlanding adventure, you know, cross-cultural, cross-border kind of trip?
Yeah, I'd say do your research and follow the right people.
How do you find the right people?
They're the people that look like this, the old gray people.
Their hair has changed color. Yeah.
It's the dudes that are really been there and really done it, and they've done the hard yards, like I was saying. And they're out there, you know, and most of them have media of some sort. They'll have books or they'll have YouTube channels and stuff like that. And it's easy to dismiss advice and think, well, I'd rather have the large tires than the this, or I'd rather have this than that. And if you look at the long termers, the guys who really live their lives on the road, I mean, their rigs are quite simple, you know, they're quite standard in a lot of ways. And they have gear that is falling apart because they love it and they keep it and it works for them. So I think that would be the one thing. It was like, look at the people that not just get the big numbers on social media and stuff, but the people who have got the respect, in the community. And those are the guys that you kind of want to listen to.
Okay.
And then the other advice would be also to understand what you really want. You know, it's like these are big concepts. It's easy to say but difficult to do. Like knowing your style of travel, how do you know until you've established it? But you got to know what you want, and you got to know how you're going to achieve it, and you got to think, well, how am I going to do this financially? You know, and those are difficult questions to answer, but the start. So I'm like, if you're talking about a dude who wants to travel the world or someone who wants to get into overlanding or whatever, the idea I think was be start small, don't invest in all the gear, invest in a decent vehicle, Even if it's just a banger that you're going to chuck after a while, it doesn't have to be your forever vehicle.
Right.
But get yourself a dependable old thing and just go and do it, you know, and grow with it. And that's the problem is like so many people, they try straight away to just look like their expedition overland, with all due respect. And I love those guys. But that's what I say, that people try and emulate that. So they try and get the Toyota that's full of the gear, and then now we're overlanding. It was like, you haven't even left your driveway yet, and you spend a ton of cash, you know.
Yeah.
Take the old banger and go do it, and then grow as you go.
Have you found validity in the mantra of keep everything stock that you can? Because people talk about going to places in different parts of the world where if you need a CV or a U-joint brake or something, you can probably get an off-the-shelf OEM replacement. But if you're upgrading things, you're not going to get a power stop brake sent to you in Morocco the next day. You know, but if you have an OEM pad or rotor, you can probably find a Toyota dealer that has it. Have you experienced that at all?
When I started overlanding, I knew how to change a tire. I could make some stuff and bolt some stuff on, do this and the other, but I really, when it came to mechanics, I didn't know much at all. It was a case of having to learn as I go. So it made sense for me to keep things standard, because I didn't grow up in a car culture. I didn't grow up tinkering in a garage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was listening to Metallica and Chasing Skirts.
As you do.
Anyway, so keeping it simple made a lot of sense to me. But there's also certain upgrades that you can do that are off the shelf, kind of like upgrading your cooling fans, for instance, like, because you can get those fans anywhere, or making certain upgrades, like things I do is monitoring systems, like monitoring my coolant. It's much more important for me that I can monitor my coolant, or you know, than have an extra 25 horsepower,
right?
You know,
right. It's
all about priorities and what's important when you're doing an upgrade, considering where you'll be traveling.
Have you ever had an issue with regulations or legal constrictions because of the vehicle that you have? You know, like in some states in the U.S., if you have oversized tires and you don't have fender flares that cover them, you can get a ticket. Like, have you had any kind of vehicle-related legal questions?
One problem we have or had is that, or still have actually, is that the Land Rover is right-hand drive. Technically we weren't allowed to cross into Chile. Technically we weren't supposed to drive across Costa Rica. But coming back to this humility thing, when we cross the borders, the guys love us. The customs guys, the immigration dudes, they love us. We don't give them a hard time. We do what we're told. We don't make waves. We just, yes, sir, no, sir, do what's, and they, so they don't even think about looking at the vehicle. You know, you hear these stories about people getting the entire vehicles emptied out and searched at borders. I've never had that.
Yeah.
Never. Not even crossing from Colombia to Panama.
Really?
Because we're just so chill, man. Wow. We're just so chill. Wow. We're like, hey, you know, it's cool. What do you want? What do you want? So, yeah, we crossed into Chile a bunch of times, and we crossed Costa Rica, and they didn't even think to look at the vehicle because I think we were just such cool people.
Harmed them.
So good.
Yeah. Of course.
Speaking of charming, you've made some friends along the way. What's it like making travel friends that may or may not have the same end destination goal as you?
In what way? Like geographically?
Yeah. If you meet somebody in Panama, and you become instant great friends. But their plan is to go one direction, and yours is the other direction. How does that work? How do you, you know, how does on the road friend life happen and work here?
It's a lot easier now that you've got social media. But I think what you'll find is a lot of long distance, long-term travelers. A lot of us tend to be kind of, what's the word? Private, kind of independent. You kind of become that way, I think, you know? So, you'd hang out with people for 3 or 4 days, have the greatest time of your life. And then like, okay, see you when we see you.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, you brought up, this is Diplie. This is Jan and Leonie Forster.
That's cool.
They're South Africans as well. They've been traveling. They first started traveling in the 50s.
Oh,
they took a 2CV Citroën, which Jan just sold like last year. And they traveled around South America. Then they had kids and they took a break for a while. And then they traveled again. And then they took this old girl and they were traveling with her. So Jan and Leonie, we met them in Flagstaff at the Overland Expo.
Expo West.
It was and it was our first year at the Overland Expo, and we made quite a an impression, I think. And everyone was inviting us to go to parties and do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then these two came along and said, "Come and have dinner with us." And we were like, "These are the dudes we're going to have dinner with." You know, there's all the industry bigwigs, but these are the people we need to talk to. You know, these are the people we need to respect and spend some time with. And I'm glad we did.
Right.
And they're amazing, truly inspirational. Leonie is, and I'm very lucky to have my Louisa. She's very, very similar to Leonie. They're ladies, you know, they're women in every sense of the word. You know, they're mothers, they're wives. But at the same time, they're the kind of people that can travel. I mean, my wife will follow me to the ends of the earth, and she's done it already. You know, and she'll make it better the whole way there, and she'll make it better the whole way back. Leonie and Louisa are kindred spirits.
That's fantastic.
That's
so, yeah, when it comes to the friend thing, so, you can tell I go off on a tangent and you got to kind of just reel me back in.
We got a long time.
That's why we have a podcast.
So with friends, I mean, I've got friends that I've had barbecues with on 3 different continents. I've had people that I've run into in Europe and then again in Africa and in the Americas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's this very, very small tribe of the long-termers, and they get around. They get around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see them. And the social media certainly helps.
That's pretty cool. So what are you up to now? You're in Mexico. What's the story with the Mexico expedition?
It's not so much of an expedition. So we, at the start of COVID, we were in a campsite in South Africa with our Land Rover. And we were trying to get from Cape Town up to Turkey, then across the Stans and across Russia to Vladivostok. And then we were going to come across to the US.
Wow.
And that would have completed our circumnavigation of the planet in some ways. And then COVID happened when we were in the campsite. And so we had to, South Africa went through some very serious lockdowns. And the borders were closed, the states were closed. You weren't allowed to go out unless you were going to get food, blah, blah, blah. So obviously that put a real pain in the, I mean, that put a stop to our journey. So we just waited it out.
Yeah.
And then we figured out, okay, we can, once borders open, we hit the borders. And we got as far as Tanzania, the border of Tanzania.
Hmm.
And then Ethiopia just erupted in war. And there was, South Sudan was at war. There was no way around it. And It was an impossible situation. And we had just gone down West Africa and we really weren't in the mood to do it again. So we kind of retreated back to South Africa eventually. And I was talking to my friend of mine, Chris Rattay, who is someone you should have on the podcast sometime. Guinness World Record holder for traveling around the world on motorbikes with his wife.
Happily.
And
that's awesome.
He, whenever I need help, Chris seems to phone me for some reason. He's one of those guys we've met in how many countries. And he phones me and he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. He's like, why don't you do this? And I was like, I like that idea. Maybe I should do that. And his suggestion was go to America. Mm-hmm. You know, America's open. You can go to America. And we're like, oh, okay. So we flew to the States, borrowed a busted up old Range Rover.
That's where the Range Rover came in.
That's where the Range Rover. Bolted a bunch of shit on it, crammed ourselves in there, and then drove it from the Florida Keys all the way up to Maine, Lubeck, I think it's called, the border with Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Then across to
yeah, you drove right past
California. Bay. Yeah. Lovely part of the world. Absolutely love it. And then, yeah, I drove across to California, and then the roach, she broke down, man, all the time. But she's a Land Rover, so there's always a fix eventually. And us, one of the show notes was like, what were the similarities between the Defender and the Range Rover?
Yeah.
One of the similarities is the community.
Okay.
And you can't beat the Land Rover community. No, there's not a brand on this planet that could come even close to the Land Rover community. We broke down in a blueberry field in Maine.
Aren't they pretty?
There we go.
The blueberry fields? They're so...
There we go.
It's so pretty up and there. Man.
It is. And there's free blueberries because there's no fences. But
too.
The Range Rover broke. The U-joint went. And we landed up, pushing her into this field with the blessing of the owner of the field, who came over, who told us a story that his dad had been in Europe back in the 50s or 60s. He bought an old series Land Rover. Then he toured around Europe with it. Then he shipped it to that farm in Maine. And then the farmer's brother, when he went to go study at Oxford or something in the UK, he took the Land Rover with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the father and the farmer flew over and they toured around Scandinavia, Morocco, whatever, with this old Land Rover. And then they shipped it back and it was actually sitting in the guy's workshop.
Wow, that's awesome.
So he was cool with us breaking down in his blueberry field. And then there's a discovery there. We put it out. Where we broke down, it was like 300 feet from where we broke down. We had great internet, but where we broke down, we had nothing. Thank you, AT&T. And we put it out there, like we're stuck in this field. And this guy, Bruce, showed up the next day with a fully rebuilt front prop shaft, the tools, a blanket for us to lie on, the nuts, the bolts, everything. And we put it back together. And half an hour later, we were sitting having bacon and pancakes.
Yeah, the off-road community really, really does. Like, people.
Wait till you get a Land Rover. It's even crazier.
But people talk shit, like Jeep and Toyota people and Land Rover. Everybody talks shit about different makes and fans of different makes, but we're all ultimately in this together.
You just need to find the right guys, Ross.
Yeah, I have the right guys. I have a small squad, and we love each other, and it's pretty awesome.
You'll see when you're traveling internationally, it doesn't matter what you use. What vehicle you use, because the other travelers will help you. But the beauty of driving a Land Rover is that the Land Rover, local Land Rover community will help you. And they've done it before. They came and picked us up in Bogota and fixed our Land Rover and whatever. Wow. I lost my Leatherman. I thought I lost my Leatherman through that hole in the floor. That's the driver's footwell.
In the Range Rover?
Yeah, that's the Range Rover. We fixed it. By the time we gave it back, man, it was in great condition.
It's a great shape.
The Land Rover or the Leatherman?
Oh, yeah. You can't leave home without a Leatherman. One of your things is what's essential. It's a good attitude and a Leatherman.
Can confirm. So
this is my way of answering the story about what we're doing in Mexico is by telling you everything that happened before.
works.
There's a story for a story. So your Mexico tenure has nothing to do with the Baja 1000?
No. We're far away from Baja.
Just incidental.
Yeah. So after the Yeah, but South Central.
Baja was like, also south 10 days of Guadalajara. Ago. Okay. Okay. So how?
So after the Range Rover,
temperature.
Sorry, yeah?
Right now.
No, nope, keep going.
After the Range Rover, I got a friend called John Turner, and he's one of the directors of Nimble Campers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, "Hey, dude, I'm not using this thing. You want to use it?" I was like, "Yes." And
things you can't say no to.
We used it for a little while, and then it was actually very good for the company. They got some great exposure because people like to follow us.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're always doing crazy stuff. And the next thing was like, I had this thing for 18 months. We were going to go take it down to South America, the Nimble. Freaking loved that thing. Absolutely love it.
That's pretty
cool. And that was in Belize. I managed to drive into a drainage ditch in the rainforest.
Of course.
So, bend parts.
The control arm. So in Belize, there's a massive Mennonite community, and they control all the auto stores and the chicken shops.
Ah. I never guessed that.
Yeah. And very nice auto stores. And the Dodge Ram, talking about choosing your vehicle, that's used up and down the Americas. Everywhere. So in Belize, I saw tons of those. The Gen 2. So
interesting.
Gen 3?
That's the ditch. Too small, I can't see.
That's quite a ditch.
Yeah, that's like a 2000 to 2005, 6 Gen?
Yeah, it's 2006 with a 5.9 Cummins. Beautiful engine. I love that thing.
Cummins engines are the best.
So while I was in the ditch down in Belize, I said to John, you know what? Like, I don't think we're going to make it to South America. COVID was still like absolutely mad. It was impossible to get visas and stuff like that. And what I'd established with the Nimble is that the vehicle did very, very well in the cold.
Okay.
It was perfectly suited to cold weather travel. So I said to John, I was like, hey, man, let's do something in the cold. Let's like go to the Arctic Ocean in winter. And he was like, oh, okay, I'll come with you. And so a plan was hatched.
Good God.
And that's where
it looks cold, Ross.
Like, which highway do you take to get there?
We took the Cassiar up and the Alcan down.
Alcan, okay.
This isn't even north. This is Donner Pass. It's still California.
That Donner Pass was worse than anything, almost anything we drove before Dawson City.
That's
really
fun. Which is up near the Alaskan border. That Donner, man, that's... I've actually driven over that in blizzards, in snow, I think about 4 times. And it's crazy.
How many times have you driven it total?
4 times.
Every time it's been a blizzard.
I don't think I've ever driven it in good weather.
That's pretty funny. It's dealing with things.
How much space is inside the Nimble? Like, how much room is going on in there?
We could sleep 4 of us.
Okay.
And my son and I are both 6'5". 250 pounds plus. I've lost a bunch of weight. He has, and he's a fucking bear of a man. But he'd take the dinette and turn that into a bed, and then we'd just my daughter, myself, and my wife would just sleep on the overhang bed. It's a king size bed. Not quite a king, more like a queen. But yeah, no, we could do it. It was much. Bad. 3 of us was much more comfortable, and 2 was perfect. But yeah, it's a great vehicle. It's got the lifting roof with and it's actually really well insulated. Like I said, we were camping at -46, -50, and never let us down. That thing, unbelievable.
That's very fucking cold.
So when it's that cold and it's a 5.9 Cummins, did you was there like a generator to do like the engine block heater?
So we made a mistake the first night that, because we were driving up the Alcan and then we started heading toward Whitehorse, and then it was running, getting late, and we landed up sleeping in a ditch. That was the day before that photo. Not a ditch, in a valley, in a pool, in a valley. And that's where all the cold air goes. And it was minus 36 during the night. Jesus. And we woke up and I was like, there is no way this Dodge is starting. There's not a chance.
It's an auto.
And I don't think it's got proper, I don't think it's got low plugs. It's some other heating, preheating.
Is it a stick shift truck or an automatic truck?
That was automatic.
Okay. Oh, yeah, you're fucked.
Yeah. No, she started, and then we just let her warm up for like half an hour.
Okay.
And then what happened there is we left that valley, and we pulled over. John was in his Ford 4x4 van, and he pulled over for some reason. And Louisa got out to just, because we always get out and just check everything's all right after driving for a while. And she was like, "Oh, it's pissing oil." And I was like, "What?" We got out, and it was pissing oil. Yeah. With the 5.9, it's got a breather on it, on the top of the valve cover, and then it goes down to like a filter thingy, and obviously because of the extreme cold, that filter had blocked up, so the oil was coming out of the gasket around the valve cover.
Oh no!
And your heart stopped. It took us for a while second, to figure right? it out.
Yeah. So now I'm standing.
Shit your pants! Oh no.
Exactly. But John, I was with, is an engineer, and he's a smart dude. And it's his vehicle. And I'm like, if you're willing to take the risk, I'll keep on driving. He's like, okay, we're cool. Let's keep going.
So did the filter warm up enough?
No, it never did.
Huh.
It never did. So we eventually just disconnected it. And it released that pressure, and it sprayed a little bit of oil now and then. But as far as I know, John still hasn't fixed it. It works perfectly as it is, so he just hasn't changed it. So what we eventually learned to do is either keep the vehicle running the whole night, or find a place where we can plug in the block heater. That was just fine. Because so John was with us in his van, and he rolled it on the way to Dawson City.
Oops.
He somersaulted it into a snowbank. Yeah, you'll find it somewhere. There's a video of my social media of him. It was a dash cam footage of him somersaulting this thing.
Okay, I found at least an image of the van, but I gotta find the dash cam.
Yeah, it's there, you'll see. And it's on Instagram.
Oh my God.
So he rolled this thing. I stop, and you know how long it takes to stop when you're driving? It's 50 miles an hour. It's still, you need 300 feet to stop.
Yep.
Even with spiked tires. Oh. Not spiked. What do you call it? Studded.
Studded.
Studded tires.
Yeah, studded tires.
Oh.
Boom.
Oh,
my God. Okay, audio listeners, you have to go.
Check.
Mike. God.
Go to Graham's Instagram, look for all the white snow stuff, and then you'll find it.
Yeah. So literally, that's his dash cam.
He's got a backwards facing
rear. Yeah.
Oh,
boom.
Man.
This is what we saw.
Jesus.
Speaking of trying to stay calm while you're traveling, good Lord. Because those vans are not like, they're decent, but like, how many crushed vans have we seen over the years? Like,
So
very quickly. Again,
John, he's an engineer. He's an ex-military guy. He's rolled a few cars in his time. He's been trained how to do it, or at least how to survive it.
Oh my God.
And it was him and his service dog, MCAT. And so we pulled up next to him, pulled him out. He was fine, made a cup of tea. And waited for the RCMP to arrive, the Mounties.
Mountie boys.
And they came back. We got the van towed up and then put all of his shit in the Nimble with us and then carried on going.
Okay. That was my next question. Is like, did the van continue?
It was drivable.
What?
If we, yeah, because he landed in snow. If there had been a boulder or a like a log or anything hard, he would have been screwed. But so he drifted, hit the snow, it sucked him in, and then he somersaulted it, and then landed and just in a snow pile.
Yeah. Once it gets you, so, it gets you bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So counter steering out of snow. If, I mean, if,
yeah, it's crazy. So if we had to, we could have recovered him with the nimble, and I think we probably would have got it going again, and we could have been able to keep going, but not all the way up to the Arctic Ocean. That would have been insane.
Yeah, that would have been a heroic mission of missions. speaking of, as I look at the clock here, and I know our time is relatively limited, can you tell us about writing books about your travels and presumably writing while doing the travels?
Yeah, writing was something that I dreamt of being a writer when I was a kid. I grew up in difficult circumstances. We didn't have money for school and stuff like that. And I left school and I applied for a couple of journalist jobs, and I was almost got them. But I was always beat out by somebody with a degree or whatever. And then eventually I just gave up on that idea and never really got back to it, but I'd always loved it. And when we started traveling, I got this idea, you know, after we traveled from Cape Town to Dar es Salaam and then circumnavigated South America, I was like, I think this could be a decent book. So I wrote the first one, which is second from the right, which is with the Land Rover and through the doorway.
Yeah.
And that was called We'll Be Free. And that it turned out to be a very popular book. I really enjoyed the writing process, and we had to go back and do a bunch of editing because we learned a lot about writing as we carried on.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that is almost our most popular book. It's the most, it's the biggest selling. But our most popular book would be the one on the far left, and that's Travel the Planet Overland. And that we wrote, Louisa and I wrote that together in 2016. And that was how to do what we do and everything that we've learned
that long ago.
While traveling. That's a good one. That's like everything we know. So all the stuff that they don't tell you in the other books.
That you don't tell.
Well, it's not very academic. Because the way I write is I write with a sense of humor, and I like to take the piss of myself and other people. I like to have fun.
Yes, you do.
As you should. As you should.
As you should.
I've read We Will Be Free, so you're good. I appreciate your writing style.
Oh, yeah. It's
very straightforward. Oh, good.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cheeky, hey? The first couple of pages, you're like, this isn't going to be what I thought it was going to be.
100%. As soon as I started, I was like, oh, yes.
Oh. Juicy. Yeah. But that was a big book. And then Overlanding the Americas, La Lucha. That was Argentina to Alaska, across the U.S., converting the Land Rover into the camper.
Mm-hmm.
That was followed Europe Overland and Mud Malaria. Well, Europe Overland was, you know, you think of Europe, you don't really think of it as a overland destination, really, but it is. Right. It can be.
Right.
And the most prolific overlanders you'll find on this planet are from Europe. So that was an interesting one. And then Mud Malaria, Guns and Miracles, that was West Africa. That's the roller coaster. We'll Be Free and Mud Malaria, those are the roller coasters.
Definitely roller coasters.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a murder outside a camp in Nigeria where I was confronted by a man in camouflage carrying a Kalashnikov beating the staff, and I had to confront this guy.
God.
We had endless problems with the Land Rover. We had the greatest 4x4ing you've ever seen in your life over the mountains of the Nigerian highlands into Cameroon. We ran out of money. The gearbox broke. That was crazy. Yeah, we drove with a broken gearbox all the way from Nigeria to South Africa. But we got there. But the writing process is what we usually do is I'll I need, especially in the beginning, I needed a lot of quiet to ride. I can do with a lot more noise these days. Some of them were used to it. But then, so what we do is we'd like rent a cabin somewhere or have friends who had a farm in Brazil, like a coffee plantation with no one around except a couple of werewolves and cows. And I'd just sit there and knock out, you know, like a book. And that's what I'll do is just find a quiet place somewhere and just sit and write and write and write. And really get back into it. And the thing is, I have to relive the entire journey, the good and the bad, which at times can be very, very difficult because there's things I don't want to think about or it's like things I don't want to relive. But it's a massive learning process. And talk about self-growth. I mean, you learn so much just going through that process of writing it all out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't always, I mean, unless if you're just a straight up journalist, news reporter, you don't write things purely based on fact, like your own experience and opinion and feelings and, you know, nerves and stress and excitement and all that stuff is intertwined into what you're actually putting out. So, yeah, it's a
I think that's what tells the story.
It does.
That's what tells the story. Is people can relate to, I mean, like leaving for an international overland trip, you've given up the house, you put all your stuff in storage, you're taking kids out of school. That's nerve-wracking stuff. You know, what people wonder why I'm like pure white at the age of 48. And I'm like, so much easier just to sit at home and have a job and drink beer and go play golf on Sundays. You know, it's like, it's massive stress. And I think if you're able to, you know, to voice that and share that and help people understand, you know, what it's really about and what it really feels like and what it takes to achieve something like that, I think that's the important part. Because it's, and the principles of success that we've learned and what we've done are the principles of success in everyday life. So it's relatable, interchangeable.
Was this your Japanese hitchhiker?
Was this your Japanese hitchhiker?
Yuki, that's the man. He's crazy, man. He starts out every journey. He's traveled the whole world. And he starts out every journey with the same clothing. And it starts off white. So that clothing was white. But that's that. You see that color? You see the bag next to him? You see, that's the color of West Africa. The soil is all that red soil. And it gets on everything.
Wow.
Yeah, he would just lie in the back of the Land Rover eating bananas and sleeping while we bounced along across Gabon or whatever. Yeah, I didn't speak hardly a word of English. Sorry?
That's the dream.
The dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a good dude. That little Louis. I can't remember her name. What's her name again?
Pia?
German lady. Pia, that's right. Argentine woman married to a German scientist. And they drove across West Africa with a couple of kids. She was amazing, man. She was rock solid, that woman.
Was she
believe it. 5 feet tall.
Was it a big gray truck?
Yeah, it was a Maguire's Dutch. Like an old, I think it was a fire truck or something like that picked up for like 3,000 euros. Slapped a box on the back and then drove it across West Africa.
This thing from the back.
Good God.
That thing.
That's the cyber truck of adventure rigs.
Ross, look at it move, though. Like even the chassis seems to be moving separate from the box.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that thing was a nightmare. And it always smelled like urine. Because they had a little
toilet
that just dripped down the back. It was like a siphon or something.
So you'd
be in a campsite and it'd just be piss dripping out the back of it.
Oh.
Yeah, it looked okay, but it smelled terrible.
It's not good.
I got to try and find a better shot of it.
Don't want that. Really don't want that.
Wasn't green. Where'd it go? I had it earlier. See, now I suck at this.
That's because we've hit our time limit. Or at least for me. I do have.
It's the glory of being on the East Coast, Ross. You're pumpkin soon.
your pumpkin sip.
Oh, I'm long since pumpkin. I have to do baby stuff in the morning, so yeah, I gotta cut it.
Okay, well, I'll wrap up the show because I can't find a better shot of her truck this fast. I've been looking at the truck for like an hour.
As soon as we wrap.
Well, I can wrap it up real fast. So you can rate review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. You can like and subscribe on YouTube. Graham has many places you can follow him. Instagram is graham.r.bell.
R.bell.
But Graham is G-R-A-E-M-E. It's not what we're used to in the States all the time. But to be honest, this is the way I know how to spell Graham the most.
Graham the most.
I think it's Scottish.
And then it's a2aexpedition.com, correct?
Yeah, that's the website. And then we're A2A Expedition on Facebook as well.
Sweet. Ross is No Not Like the One from Friends, and I'm at Overlane Dad, and we've done a show. Thank you so much for joining us, Graham.
Thanks, Graham.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.